Amitav Ghosh, award-winning Indian novelist and writer. His new book is just out. It's called The Nutmeg's Curse, Parables for a Planet in Crisis. And that does it for our show. His previous book, The Great Derangement. Tomorrow on Democracy Now!, we'll speak to climate scientist Kevin Anderson and the writer George Monbiot. Democracy Now! Currently has job openings. Go to democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced with Renee Feltz, Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Tarasena, Tammy Warrenoff, Tarina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Tamari Astu, Joe John Hamilton, Robbie Karen, Hani Masood, and Adriano Contreras. Our general manager is Julie Crosby. Special thanks to Becca Staley, Paul Powell, Mike DeFilippo, Miguel Nogueira. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
What do we mean when we talk about personality? What is your personality? It is the way you get along with other people around you and with your changing environment. You want certain things from other people. The way to go about getting those things reveals your personality. Your personality is the way you affect other people. Think about that. The way you affect other people.
You are listening to KBLO Portland.
This is Constance Sharp of Rock to Recovery and co-author of the book Rock to Recovery: Music as a Catalyst for Human Transformation with Wes Geer. Asking you to tune in to KBLO on Monday, November 22nd at 11 p.m. for Eclectic Pandemic here on your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBLO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBLO Evening News, Portland City Council debates new budget, Kenosha shooter Kyle Rittenhouse testifies, and in international news, thousands suffer freezing temperatures and food shortages at the Poland-Belarus border. Good evening, this is the KBLO Evening News for Wednesday, November 10th, 2021. I'm Ethan Sandweiss. Budget hearings for the 2023 financial year are underway at the Portland City Council this afternoon. The updated budget contains two large spending proposed by Mayor Ted. The first is a $38 million investment in programs aimed at assisting houseless Portlanders. The package is jointly funded by city and county taxes, which saw an unexpected revenue last year. $18 million would go towards increasing the availability of shelter beds. The bill would also open 25 new positions for service navigation outreach workers, expand behavioral health, hygiene, and storage services, and create a street services coordination center to centralize houseless services. During a press conference, Commissioner Dan Ryan announced plans to open 6 safe rest villages for homeless campers, although so far only 2 sites have been confirmed. The second $10.1 million spending package aims to swell the ranks of the Portland Police Bureau. Bureau membership is at its lowest point since 1989, after years of resignations and staffing difficulties. Mayor Ted Wheeler's plan would increase enrollment by 200 officers and 100 unarmed community safety specialists. The city would issue the first 50 new officers or public safety specialists $25,000 signing bonuses. Included in the plan is a $2.65 million program to outfit the department with body cams. The bill is controversial, with critics citing widespread police misconduct during last year's racial justice protests. Last year, the city cut $11 million from the police budget, but failed to follow through in providing social services aimed at reducing crime. While it's true that with 77 homicides, 2021 is Portland's deadliest year on record, homicides increased by nearly 30% nationwide during the same period. A group of independent Portland researchers also failed to establish a correlation between the number of officers and the level of crime in the city. Nevertheless, some form of the police restaffing bill is likely to pass. Lone holdout Joanne Hardesty told KOIN last week that she was interested in a retire-rehire plan, provided rehired officers were not previously facing investigations. Hardesty maintains that the Portland Police Bureau is, quote, dysfunctional, and contends that the process to reform it could take years. Oregon voters decided last year to decriminalize the possession of small quantities of drugs. Since the new measure passed, the disparity in drug arrests between white Oregonians and people of color has diminished. Eric Tegedoff has more on the story.
Proponents of a measure in Oregon that decriminalized possession of a small amount of drugs are hailing the reduction in arrests after its implementation this year. Advocates say it's especially good news for communities of color, who made up a disproportionate number of drug convictions. An Oregon Criminal Justice Commission report of 2015 data found black Oregonians were convicted of felony drug possession at twice the rate of white Oregonians. For Native Americans, it was five times the rate. Jay Amechi is in Portland with the organization Freedom to Thrive.
So just by taking that away, despite the fact that we don't really have a ton of data right now because it's brand new, we know that just arresting less people and convicting less people of felonies means better outcomes for specifically Black and Native and Latina communities.
Before decriminalization in 2019, there were more than 4,000 drug convictions. This year, between February and August, there have been about 360. However, critics say the initiative has not followed through in getting people to treatment, noting the small fraction of people who have called the hotline number on citation law enforcement gives for drug possessions. Critics also point to the small number of people who have showed up in court after receiving citations. Ron Williams is with the Health Justice Recovery Alliance, which was formed to implement the new measure. He believes it will take a different way of thinking to properly assess the initiative's success.
What we want to do is we want to move addiction services away from the criminal justice frame and into the health and recovery frame. By folks continuing to focus on citations and court appearances, there's still kind of been that mindset that people who use drugs should be punished.
Williams says behavioral treatment options are growing in every county, with $30 million going out to organizations earlier this year and nearly $280 million coming soon. Importantly, he says communities of color are steering the process.
The folks who are making these decisions are people with substance use background, people who are alcohol and drug counselors, people who are case managers, people with lived experience of substance use disorder, and they're Black, Brown, Latinx, and tribal folks.
For Oregon News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
The Newburgh School Board voted 4-3 in September to ban Black Lives Matter and Pride symbols at area schools, claiming they were overtly political. The case received national attention, as did a mock slave auction of Black students led by some of their white classmates during the same period. Last night, the school board voted 4-3 once again to fire District Superintendent Joe Morlock without citing a cause. The conservative board majority had previously vented frustration that Morlock was not properly enforcing their ban on diversity symbols. Morlock was popular among Newburgh educators. According to the board member Brandy Penner, Morlock, quote, pulled us out of financial ruin, rebuilt community, and rebuilt relationships. In a matter of 3 months, four people have completely destroyed that. In contrast, Newburgh teacher who went to school in blackface last September was placed on administrative leave. Morlock's contract was meant to last until June 2024. Why is a gaming destination not a casino? Oregon's nine indigenous tribes oppose a proposal to open 225 betting terminals at a new destination resort. Billionaire Dutch Bros Coffee founder Travis Boersma plans to construct the new resort called Flying Lark beside the Grants Pass Downs horse track. The tribes argue this decision violates the state constitution. When voters created the Oregon Lottery in 1984, they also approved a constitutional prohibition for off-reservation casinos. Erin Patterson, a spokeswoman for Flying Lark, says the project is, quote, permitted to operate historical horse racing machines under Oregon law, which exempts HHR machines from the definition of casino. Tribal officials are questioning the legality of that loophole. Besides the 225 betting terminals, the Flying Lark will include restaurants, bars, live entertainment, and RV parking, as well as offices for the Oregon Racing Commission, which will be paid around $200,000 a year. Since the closure of Portland Meadows in 2019, Grants Pass Downs is the state's only commercial racetrack. A Labor Department report shows that prices rose by 0.9% in October, twice September's rate. The annual rate of inflation now stands at about 6.2%. That's America's highest since December 1990, when global oil prices rose sharply after the Iraqi invasion of Kuwait. The Labor Department says the increase was broad-based, with increases in the new indexes for energy, shelter, food, used cars and trucks, and new vehicles among the larger. Energy prices are up 30% last year, while food is up 5.3%. The Biden administration and the Federal Reserve claim that rising costs are temporary consequences of COVID-19's impact on global supply chains. Economic forecasters, though, predict inflation could remain high longer than the Fed predicts. As inflation rises, the Federal Reserve faces pressure to raise interest rates. Doing so would make loans more expensive from everything from college to cars. Congressman Paul Gosar tweeted a doctored anime clip yesterday which showed him killing Alexandra Ocasio-Cortez and President Joe Biden. Paul Gosar insists the clip was metaphorical, but the Arizona representative has established connections to violent white supremacist groups, the Proud Boys, and the Oath Keepers. Gosar also attended a fundraiser in February headlined by Holocaust denier Nick Fuentes. His siblings previously demanded that he be expelled from Congress for his alleged role planning the January 6th Capitol attack. Gosar's Republican colleagues remain conspicuously silent on the video. Some critics contrast the incident with a 2017 stunt by comedian Kathy Griffin, who faced condemnation across the aisle for a photoshopped picture holding then-President Trump's severed head. With more on that story and others, it's Mary Sherman with 2021 Talks.
Welcome to 2021 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
There is no place for any type of violence or that type of language in the political system, and it should not be happening.
White House Deputy Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre commented on an animated video tweeted by Republican Representative Paul Gosar of Arizona, depicting him killing Democratic Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. Gosar's office denied he intended to cause harm and said the cartoon was a symbolic representation of the, quote, policy monster of open borders, unquote. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi called for an ethics and law enforcement investigation. At the Global Climate Talks in Glasgow, Scotland, Pelosi promoted the Build Back Better plan, which she says will create economic prosperity for everyone.
Universal pre-K and child care, child tax credit, family and medical leave, which we hope will stay in the bill, the issue that relates to home health care. All of these things enable families, whether it's dads or moms, but largely moms, to be in the workplace.
A vote on the bill could come next week. President Joe Biden condemned House Republicans considering retaliation against 13 members who voted for the $1.2 trillion bipartisan infrastructure bill. 19 Republican senators, including Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, voted for the measure in August. Meanwhile, GOP senators can't count on New Hampshire Governor Chris Sununu to join them. He's announced he's not running for the Senate next year, surprising party members who hoped he could win the seat.
I'd rather push myself 120 miles an hour delivering wins for New Hampshire than to slow down, end up on Capitol Hill, debating partisan politics without results.
Former Trump advisor Stephen Miller and Press Secretary Kayleigh McEnany are among the latest subpoenas issued by the January 6th Select Committee. A legal fight continues between the panel and Trump over access to his White House records. A House committee examined the ways discrimination limits financial opportunity for the LGBTQ plus community. David Johns is executive director of the National Black Justice Coalition.
Leveling the playing field to ensure that every American has economic opportunity is essential to preserving our democracy. And it's especially important for Black, LGBTQ plus, and same gender loving people, communities, and families who disproportionately struggle economically, often to no fault of our own.
Witnesses called for federal protections for LGBTQ plus people in employment, housing, and banking. Pfizer is asking the FDA to approve booster shots of its COVID-19 vaccine for all adults 18 and over. CEO Albert Bourla had choice words for those who spread false information about the vaccines.
Bad people are criminals because they literally costed millions of lives.
Finally, former U.S. Senator and Vietnam veteran Max Claylin died Tuesday at 79 from congestive heart failure at his home in Atlanta. After he lost both legs and an arm in Vietnam, he credited President Carter with giving him a path in life when he selected him to head the U.S. Veterans Administration. He served in the upper chamber from 1997 to 2003. Cole Hemstreet contributed reporting. I'm Mary Sherman for Pacifica Network and Public News Service.
KBOO News poet Dan Raphael sees too many acting without bearing consequences.
An Arizona congressman tweets an anime of himself beheading Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and suffers no consequence. Several of Trump's minions defy congressional subpoenas with any actions against them stalled by lawsuits. In Nicaragua, President Daniel Ortega realized the consequence of jailing your political opponents is winning a fourth term. Looks like COP26 will only be of negative consequence, as the rich polluting nations take no actions, just promises too late in the future, while the leaders of nations too poor to have caused much planetary damage realize the value of resources only they now have. Let's bring back some expected consequences, like good pay for hard work, like societal safety nets for folks in need. But what are appropriate consequences for those who profit from destroying the planet, from diminishing the lives of those living on it, the consequences of profiting from disease? And it seems the consequence of the rich avoiding taxes while defense spending and corporate welfare keep going up may be inflation for the rest of us, already cutting corners on necessary expenses. For Poetic Justice, this is Dan Raphael.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth report on the importance of creating a legacy contact in online accounts, followed by a story on how a membership service called Ridwell can help Portland Metro residents divert hard-to-recycle waste. Tonight's weather is in the 50s and rainy. Tomorrow's weather will also be the 50s and rainy. Welcome to Portland. Today in 1944, the USS Mount Hood exploded off of New Guinea. The American ammunition ship took 350 sailors with her and injured another 371. The quote of the day is from the U.S. Geological Survey. Mount Hood is an active volcano close to rapidly growing communities, recreation areas, and major transportation routes, and therefore imposes a heightened risk. Pharmaceutical giant Moderna faces criticism for claiming sole invention of its vaccine in its patent application. However, the project received significant federal investment. Three National Institutes of Health scientists worked extensively on the vaccine, and the NIH provided significant funding. Acknowledging that contribution would make those scientists, as well as the NIH, co-owners of the patent. It could also cut into Moderna's profits. Zane Rivesy, research director at Public Citizen, said, quote, co-ownership can empower the U.S. government to authorize additional manufacturers to use some mRNA 1273 patents around the world. Rivesy added, quote, Moderna has used public science and public funds totaling billions of dollars to develop a vaccine largely available to the rich. In a July filing with the United States Patent and Trademark Office, Moderna said it had, quote, reached the good faith determination that the NIH scientists did not co-invent the component in question, and named several of its own employees as the sole inventors. 18-year-old Kyle Rittenhouse stands trial for murdering two people and injuring a third last year at a racial justice protest in Kenosha, Wisconsin. The pro-Trump teenager was caught on camera shooting several protesters with an AR-15 rifle and walking away past watching police. The trial is being seen nationally as a referendum on politically motivated homicide at protests. Rittenhouse testified today at the Kenosha courthouse, claiming he was verbally threatened and sobbing profusely. The first victim, 36-year-old Joseph Rosenbaum, was reaching for Rittenhouse's rifle when the teenager shot him four times. After Rittenhouse killed Rosenbaum, 26-year-old Anthony Huber attacked him with a skateboard and again attempted to disarm him. Rittenhouse shot him once. Rittenhouse's sole surviving victim, Gage Grosskreutz, drew his pistol after Huber was killed. Rittenhouse shot Grosskreutz in the arm. The self-defense team hopes for a mistrial, claiming Rittenhouse acted in self-defense. Despite a preponderance of evidence to the contrary, Circuit Judge Bruce Schrader made things more difficult for the prosecution. He ruled in October that the men shot by Rittenhouse cannot be referred to as victims, but rioters was still deemed acceptable. Judge Schrader interrupted cross-examination twice during the trial to admonish the prosecution, at times yelling for improper lines of questioning that purportedly violated Rittenhouse's right to remain silent. At one point, Judge Schrader's ringtone went off, blaring Lee Greenwood's God Bless the USA. The song is famously played at Trump rallies whenever Trump gets on stage. Schrader said today that he will consider the defense's petition for a mistrial with prejudice. If granted, the case would be dismissed without a jury deliberation, and Rittenhouse would be immune from further prosecution for his multiple murder. Overlapping with the Rittenhouse trial, a bill in the Ohio State House could broadly outlaw civil protest. If it does become law, crimes committed during a protest could also be punished more harshly. Here with more is Mary Sherman.
An Ohio bill dubbed by opponents as anti-free speech is up for a possible vote. House Bill 109 increases the penalties for rioting and creates the offenses of riot assault and riot vandalism. It also increases the penalty for disorderly conduct when the offender hinders the movement of people during a riot or illegal protest. David Lima with the Northeast Ohio chapter of Showing Up for Racial Justice contends it will discourage Ohioans from participating in civil demonstrations for fear of legal action.
The language is broad, it's vague, the laws are duplicative and unnecessary, and they have actually created new sets of crimes with significantly enhanced penalties and costly fines.
The measure also creates the offense of bias-motivated intimidation that prohibits a person from harming another person or property based on the victim's status as a first responder. Proponents say it supports the right to peacefully assemble while holding those who break the law accountable. The Ohio House Criminal Justice Committee could vote on the measure today. Michael Weinman with the Fraternal Order of Police of Ohio says first responders faced verbal threats, harassment, and physical violence in responding to calls during riots in the wake of George Floyd's death. He says they need to be able to provide assistance free of attacks.
When these protests do turn violent, and they all didn't, we know that, but when it does happen, we need to be able to restore order. It's not only protecting property, but we had situations where people were pulled out of cars and beaten. It had nothing to do with anything.
However, Lima says the bill goes as far as to target the organizations that sponsor protests by holding them liable for the illegal actions of participants.
You never know who's going to show up for protests, and you never know what their intentions are. And so it will have the effect of having organizations think twice whether they want to go through with the protest.
Lima says the bill will suppress free speech and points out that 93% of the protests between May and August of 2020 across the country were nonviolent. Support for this reporting was provided by Media in the Public Interest and funded in part by the George Gunn Foundation. I'm Mary Sherman.
Thousands of people fleeing war zones in Asia, Africa, and the Middle East are stranded at the Polish-Belarusian border between two armies squaring off. They face sub-zero temperatures with little shelter or supplies. Most of these refugees hope to reach amnesty in the EU and eventually make their way to Germany. Those who make it past the razor wire border fence set up by the Polish government are free to remain in Europe. However, the Polish government refuses to grant immigrants safe passage. The border standoff has been widely cast in the news as an extension of diplomatic tensions between NATO and Russia's proxies. Poland's government hurled blame at the government of the Belarusian dictator Alexander Lukashenko, claiming that the Russian ally offered false promises to migrants in order to spike a border crisis. EU officials noted that flights to Minsk from the Middle East doubled in the past week. Travel agencies in Iraq have been offering Belarus visas and airfare to travelers. Confrontation may be Moscow's intent, but Poland's ultranationalist government has come under fire for ignoring EU standards on human rights and immigration, as well as procedurally dismantling the country's democratic institutions. Poland's ruling Law and Justice Party has long employed invasion rhetoric against immigrants and has mobilized 15,000 soldiers to prevent immigrant families from entering their country. Director of Save the Children Europe, Anita Bay, said publicly that Poland's stance at the border was, quote, against EU laws and values. The government of Poland issued a state of emergency, barring reporters from entering the area. Press freedom is non-existent in neighboring Belarus. Still, leaked images of people with injuries are emerging at the border, with migrants claiming they were beaten by Belarus border guards. At least 8 immigrants are confirmed dead. Lukashenko's benefactors at the Kremlin also flew nuclear-capable bombers near the border in a show of intimidation. Russian troops have also gathered for weeks along the Belarusian and Ukrainian borders. The search for mass graves at Canadian residential schools continues. After the discovery last summer of over 1,000 human bodies at Catholic Church-run schools for Native children, investigators work across the country to discover the extent of the deaths. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Another search at a site of a former residential school in Canada is underway, this time in Ontario. A search started in Saskatchewan this week at a former school site. Both are using ground-penetrating radar. Dan Karpinchuk reports.
A task force made up of Six Nations police, survivors, and community members are using 2 ground-penetrating radar machines to conduct grid searches of about 500 acres of land around the former school, the Mohawk Institute Residential School. One survivor says she takes comfort in knowing that this sacred work is being done in a good way with the participation of the community. Mark Hill is a member of the Mohawk Nation and the chief of the Six Nations of the Grand River.
We have finally made it to this day where we are ready to begin the search. Survivors have been telling us for years the stories of what happened to them in these so-called schools. This investigation and the important work that comes with it is for survivors and is led by survivors.
The search is expected to continue all week. First Nations counselors will be on hand to help prepare the community for the potential findings.
When the U.S. went into lockdown, many people relied on the internet to work, learn, and live their lives. That's been impossible in many rural tribal communities that lack high-speed service. The urgency of the pandemic has led to broadband reaching some remote areas. KYUK's Greg Kim reports on what that means for Akiak, a village in western Alaska.
Akiak resident Lena Foss salvaged a broken dryer from the village's dump. She couldn't figure out how to fix it.
First thing I did was YouTube how to replace a belt. But the internet was so slow, and I thought it was wasting gigabytes, so I turned that off before I completely finished how to fix that dryer.
Located in remote western Alaska, Akiak lacks high-speed internet. But once the village gets broadband later this month, internet speeds will more than double and costs will become a fraction of what they are now. The main reason for these advances is because of COVID, according to Blair Levin, a broadband expert at the Brookings Institution.
It really focused the mind of everyone, Democrats, Republicans, governors, senators, on the importance of getting broadband everywhere and making sure that everybody could afford to get on.
Since the pandemic hit, the federal government made billions of dollars available to expand broadband. A good chunk went to rural tribal lands, some of the least connected areas in the country. But money was only a piece of the puzzle for Akiak. The tribe is also reliant on satellite technology that just became available this year in Alaska. These satellites can deliver high-speed internet to rural areas that cables can't reach. Reporting for National Native News in Akiak, I'm Greg Kim.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, November 10th, 2021. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast is Dan Raphael. Producer is myself, Ethan Sandweiss, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Antonia Gonzalez, Dan Raphael, Eric Tagetoff, and Mary Sherman. The director of the evening news is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Ethan Sandweiss. All of our KBOO programs, including the evening news, are supported by our members. If you'd like to become a member and support your local community radio station, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for a report on the importance of creating a legacy contact in online accounts.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
What is it that we leave behind? For those of us who've grown up on the internet, we know about some things you shouldn't leave behind online and some things that you will no matter what. Passwords, internet history, public posts, they're all things to be careful of who has access to them. But what about digital mementos? On certain email providers and social medias, there's an option to create a legacy contact to allow a loved one to inherit your data once your account is inactive for a period of time. To learn more about the importance of setting up a legacy contact, I spoke with Camille Demir, who works in social media and marketing. So you brought something to my attention that I wanted to ask you more about, which is emails and not being around to answer them anymore.
A lot of people don't realize that they have this whole treasure trove of information that doesn't actually have a legacy set up for it. Your emails, your social media, all of that. Yeah, what happens when you die to all of that stuff? It's not something that's fun to think about, but.
Well, I think that there's, you know, what would be the way to put it? Maybe like just like a trope in media that's like, if I die, like delete.